Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 3-4-2 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
What's up, though?
All right, we got the quick what's up, though. We do not have a guest, at least not yet, But here to talk some hoops, got some fun basketball that's happened over the past week or so. We're going to catch up on some news, and then we're going to dig into the Dunker Spot mailbag. So appreciate y'all for sending in questions. Also got some responses from Twitter and also Blue Sky. So appreciate y'all for sending those in. But first, let's tip into some news. On the W front, we do have a couple of head coach hirings. The Sparks hiring Lynn Roberts as their new head coach. The Atlanta Dream hiring Carl Smesko as their new head coach. Both coaches coming from the women's college basketball ranks. Both high-powered offenses that they've been the shepherds of, particularly with high three-point rates, which seems intriguing. Steve, just a general question I have for you. As a lot of conversations, at least that I've seen, has been around what they're going to do for these offenses and what that may mean for the league overall. Are you at all worried? Probably isn't the right word. But I guess just how do you kind of take in the potential evolution or just the continued acceleration of like more threes coming to the W?
I don't. Because I don't know if it's going to be apples to apples. It's all going to depend on your roster construction. It's going to depend on the adjustment period because the concepts are fine, but you have to have the players to make it work. So I don't know if it's going to be copy paste from what these coaches have done in college to the W. What I do think is, obviously teams are getting a little bit more creative, willing to go outside the box, trying to find something that works for them in this league and be innovative. So I'm intrigued to see what kind of movement and flow and pace these two coaches in particular bring to those teams who likely could need it. Because if you look at the rosters, they're not exactly fit for exactly what these coaches have done so far. But it doesn't mean they can't evolve and they can't bring things that these teams need. So I don't necessarily think it's going to be a three-point revolution immediately. I'm curious to see what other concepts they can bring in.
Gotcha. I think because we haven't had the introductory presser for Lynn yet. We have had it for Carl Smesko. I think it was earlier this week. But just listening to one, the Ryan Howard question from the presser, asking how you're going to implement these things, and listening to Carl talk about building relationships, having that open communication, that kind of collaboration, I think is going to be important to your point, to be able to balance like what he may believe conceptually versus what he has on the roster and trying to blend the two. So I'm intrigued to see how that part's going to go. I was listening to, because Carl, he hopped on the basketball podcast a couple of years ago. He was talking through some of his concepts and stuff. So I'm just trying to gather more information on who he is, what he does, that kind of thing. So I'm excited to see what he does with that dream roster. Obviously, we have expansion draft, player protections. We got free agency. We got the draft. So Atlanta's going to look a little different than what they did this past season. But the relationship between him and Ryan Howard is going to be important. Because I think as far as he can do, you know, to the limit of the copy and paste that can be had with the three-point rate in particular, like I think a lot of that will be around Ryan Howard and her usage. And we have just seen just with her skill set, she is someone that can create her own. She can fly off of screens. You know, Tanisha Wright already used her in a lot of movement sets. So I'm curious to see like how he expands upon that, how he evolves with that, and just what that means for Ryan overall, because she is the most important player in that organization. And like we had a little bit of a conversation after the Tanisha fire, where we had a mailbag question about it. And I was like, Ryan's going to be the driver of this. She's their best player, but like if she's able to evolve into a legitimate superstar versus all-star with star potential, all-star with superstar potential, like that takes the dream to another level. And it makes it a little bit easier to build and move forward and get into the upper echelon. And so I'm curious to see like what he's going to mean for her specifically.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. And I also think I'd add it's intriguing to see two college coaches just say, you know what, we're gonna take the leap to the W. That wasn't something that always happened. And so it's another sign of the W being in a really good place and it being an exciting time where, you know, a lot of people are more willing to take the jump and see if they can swim with the big fishes.
I like it. And then I guess related to the W, Unrivaled has announced their teams and most of the rosters, 34 to 36 players have been announced. We do have two wild cards, but The Vinyl, coached by Teresa Weatherspoon. They have Arike Ogunbowale, Jordan Canada, Ryan Howard, Ray Burrell, De'Erica Hamby, and Aaliyah Boston. The Rose, coached by Nola Henry, Chelsea Gray, Brittany Seitz, Kalia Copper, Lexi Hull, Angel Reese, and Azaree Stevens. The Mist, coached by Phil Handy. They have Jewel Lloyd, Courtney Vandersloot, Dejanay Carrington, Rakia Jackson, Brianna Stewart, and Aaliyah Edwards. The Lunar Owls, coached by DJ Sackman, Skylar Diggins-Smith, Natasha Cloud, Alicia Gray, a wild card, Nafisa Collier, and Shakira Austin. The Phantom, coached by Adam Harrington. They have Jackie Young, Tiffany Hayes, Marina Mabry, a wild card spot there as well, Satu Sabli and Brittany Griner. And the Laces, coached by Andrew Wade, Kelsey Plum, Courtney Williams, Kayla McBride, Kate Martin, Alyssa Thomas, and Stephanie Dolson. Steve, any early thoughts on the rosters that we have so far?
The Laces, that's my tribe.
That would do it. That would do it.
Dogs on that team. And you know what? They took Kalia Copper from that team. I ain't like that. But that's okay.
It might have been.
Got some dog.
Too much dog.
No, not, no. Never, never too much. So watch out for the Laces. That's my number one takeaway. You?
I think for me, like, you know, give me versatility in the wing or the forward room. I look at the Lunar Isles with Nafisa Collier and Shakira Austin and Alicia Gray and Natasha Cloud. I'm curious to see what the wild card spot is going to be. And then naturally, Skylar Diggins-Smith, a dog herself. Really good defender, really good driver, really good playmaker. And I'm really just curious by the 3-on-3 full court format in general. These are teams of six. Like, what are the sub patterns going to look like? I do just have general unrivaled questions that I'm excited to have answered once we get into play in January. But my eyes immediately go to the Lunar Owls. Like, that is a lot of versatility on the floor. Keeping an eye on the shooting from their roster, but they should be able to do a little bit of everything defensively, and they will get after it. So that would be my theoretical team at the very least. Shifting to the NBA side, some quick injury updates. Announced earlier today, as we record early on a Thursday, Luka Doncic with a right wrist sprain to be reevaluated in a week. Luka averaging 28-8-8 so far this season. Jumper hasn't fallen to his usual level, though Luka's no stranger to slow starts. We know how good he is overall. 32% on threes, shooting roughly 31% on shots outside of 16 feet right now, which is a career low. That was at 39% last year. So we will see if the wrist gets right. Do we see the correction there? Does Luka heat up? And ultimately, do we see the full breadth of Dallas offensively? As you mentioned on the last pod, they are top 10 in both offense and defense right now. So it's not like it's been going super poorly, but it hasn't been the usual Luka yet. So hopefully he gets well soon. Paul George hyperextending his knee again. Left last night's game, did not return. Have not gotten an update as of recording, but I would imagine he may miss a little bit of time if it is something serious. So keeping an eye on Paul George, currently averaging 15-5-5 so far this year, 28 minutes per game as he ramps up, missed the opener and things. De'Anthony Melton having ACL surgery. He's going to be out for the season. Melton averaged 10 points, 3 boards, 3 assists, and a steal in roughly 20 minutes per game this year. This was supposed to be a bounce back year for him from the health front. Only played 38 games last year, 6 games this year before the season end surgery. So more than anything, just want him to get right and get fully healthy and have a fully healthy campaign moving forward, because he is a really fun guard to watch on both ends of the floor. 3-point shooting has perked up in recent years. He is a dog at the point of attack defensively. So the Warriors have the depth to keep moving forward, but naturally would love to have De'Anthony Melton in that lineup. So hope he gets well soon. On the more positive note, from Shams Charania of ESPN, there's optimism for Kevin Durant and Bradley Beal to make their returns from calf injuries next week. As early as Tuesday against the Lakers. So we will see what the full strength of Phoenix Suns look like again. It has not been super fruitful since KD and Beal have been down. I think it's 1-6 since KD's been down. But since KD and Beal have been out of lineup, it's 0-5. They are 20th in offense, 28th in defense, 28th in net rating during that 5-game stretch. So if they are back, naturally the Phoenix Suns would like that fusion of talent back into their lineup. Before we move forward, Steve, did you have any comments you wanted to add there? Didn't want to step on your toes or anything on that front.
My toes are not stepped on. I think the Sixers got some things they need to figure out. Hopefully Paul George is okay. Unfortunate for De'Anthony Melton, so I'll echo your sentiment there. Mavericks, it'll be an interesting week, but a good chance for them to kind of get some things going, get some movement in, hopefully lock in on defense and work through that. The Luka package is the Luka package. And the Suns, they need Kevin Durant and Bradley Beal. That's not breaking news. You don't need me to tell you that. But it's interesting because so much of what they've done so far in that hot start when they started 8-1 was enhancing the KD, Beal, Booker trio and then finding other pieces that fit around it and those guys being elevated. Without KD, without Beal, defenses are saying Devin Booker, not you. And all those pieces that you had found that were contributing now have to go up a level. And it's not like they're not talented, but it's a little different when we don't just need you to make a shot. You have to make these shots. You have to make these plays. You have to create openings. Our flow and our movement's a little different because, well, do we lean in on that or do we let Devin Booker create an advantage? So I would like to see what the Suns look like once everyone's back. But the Western Conference, it changed in an instant. So you can go from 8-1, 9-7, and you can go from a top three seed to the play-in in a week. So let's see if Phoenix can kind of get back on track, get that defense going, and really start operating.
There you go. And then just very quickly to the Devin Booker point, as those other two stars have been out since November 9th with KD and Beal out of the lineup. Devin Booker, 250 pick and rolls. The Suns generating 0.9 points per possession on those pick and rolls. Devin Booker has been blitzed on 15.2% of those. So the not you portion is very much true. You see it on film. And the numbers also bear that out. So getting those two back should help alleviate some of the pressure that Devin Booker is seeing defensively. All right. Well, before hopping to the mailbag, we did get some live breaking news. Shout out producer Richie from Shams. Quote tweeting his own tweet about the new All-Star Game format. He says, how the 14 tournament style 2025 NBA All-Star Game is expected to work. Sources tell ESPN, two semifinal games up to 40 points. Winners advance. Finals game is up to 25 points. Quick burst competition, pickup ball-esque. Steve, your initial thoughts.
This is what you asked for. This is what you asked for. Don't be mad if it's the same thing, just shorter.
Quick burst competition, pickup ball-esque. I guess the pickup ball-esque part is where I am intrigued. Does this mean, like, is this we going to make it, take it? What is that portion going to mean? But no, like, I think target scores in general, like, that's not necessarily new. Matter of fact, the Rise of Stars competition is already kind of your teams you play to certain score, like, play to 30, I believe. So, like, that part isn't super different. And I think it was announced when Shams Media tweeted out last week. It's team one versus team three, team two versus team four. Naturally, winners advance. You go from there. So, like, that part isn't new. I am curious about, like, what the breaks and the substitutions are going to look like here. How they're going to fit that in. But that's just more procedural stuff. I'm intrigued at the very least.
Hey, look, I'm going to tell you this right now.
Okay.
Whatever team has faced the Rising Stars is going to win because they don't want to lose to them. And then that team's going to lose in the finals. Book it.
Ah, okay. Well, put that in pen, November 21st or 22nd, whenever this releases. We will circle back to this clip if that's what happens. Steve has been right plenty of times throughout the history of the pod, so it would not be a surprise if he is right once again. But I like the firm prediction there. It's good stuff. All right. Now we move to the Dunker Spot mailbag. Once again, you can always send your basketball questions our way. Email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. First question actually going to come from Blue Sky. Shout out Coys. Cannot imagine which soccer team this person roots for. But the question or the prompt is, make your case for why the Celtics or the Cavs should feel better about Tuesday night's result and what Kristaps Porzingis or Isaac Okoro, Caris LeVert, Dean Wade, and I will add in Max Strus, change if they're healthy.
Make my case on why. What if they both should feel better? What if I make both cases? Do I get in trouble there?
You might get a follow-up message with some finger wagging. I don't know.
I sure won't. I think both teams should feel fine. I think if you're Boston, you have a reminder of the advantage that you've had over Cleveland and being able to mix in some of the same defensive tricks without leaning on them too much, where we could put our big on Evan Mobley, we could put Jason Tatum on Jaren Allen, we get some switching that way, we could bother you. We can attack matchups over and over and over again. So we can put Garland in action, put Mitchell in action, put Merrill in action, put any one of these guys that you want to put out there in action and get what we want. I think, you know, the way that Jason Tatum played, making quick decisions, being able to drive against Evan Mobley, I thought those were important plays. I think that's a key for Boston in this matchup. So if we're talking about the difference with Porzingis, because, I mean, look, Boston shot, what, 50% from the field, 53 from three, 44 made field goals, 32 assists. So you got to feel pretty good about that. With Porzingis, that only gets stronger because now Al can play less minutes and probably be more intense in the second unit as well. For Cleveland, I don't think you should feel terrible. I think, obviously, you didn't have all your people. If you're talking about the absence of the wings, you have more people that are the size that could, in theory, guard some of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. The tricky part is, again, the team is going to work on trying to find the different matchups. So the willingness to switch Garland onto Tatum and Brown, I think, was important. Just to know that, hey, we'll try this. We'll work this out. We'll see if we can handle a couple possessions, make you go elsewhere. I think the bench holding up was important against Boston. I think being able to compete and come back in a game where Darius Garland just didn't have it. I mean, 3 for 21. Donovan Mitchell, 13 for 29. They kept staying aggressive, but they weren't really making the shots. So I think, you know, it's a test of your formula, but ultimately, that's where you got to feel good. Evan Mobley had 22. You can find different ways. You just have to make sure Garland's ready to experience that drop, attack, stay decisive, and make the right plays. Both teams should feel okay.
Okay, I like that. I like that. I think, quickly, to agree with you, I think both teams should feel, you should feel good. I think Boston, you were able to get to your formula. And actually, they won the game and snapped the streak, so you obviously feel good about that. I guess, to more directly answer, like, I think Cleveland probably feels the best moving forward, just because you had the 3 for 21 from Garland and this still wound up being a 3-point game. Like, you were able to lean on your switching more in that second half. You were able to bog down Boston a little bit in terms of their tempo. And I think if you feel, you should feel pretty good about that portion of the program. Just very quickly on the Garland front, defended 11 pick and rolls as the screener defender per second spectrum. The Celtics only scoring 0.7 points per possession on those trips. Now, there is a world in which they get a similar volume and then Jason Tatum just absolutely abuses that matchup. That can happen. But if you're just looking at positive indicators, hey, we can slow them down, make them work a little bit deeper into the clock, or have, or, you know, kind of bait them into some of their bad habits that we've seen throughout the years of this era in Boston. And Garland held up. At the very least, statistically, he held up. And this is a game where they closed with one big and they didn't have all their wings. Does Jared Allen have a better showing on the perimeter than we saw in that game? Can you then close with Allen and Mobley, and what does that do? Like, I think there's a little bit more leeway for Cleveland to feel pretty good about, especially once you consider all the guys that they were missing. So I guess I would lean Cleveland on that front. But both teams should ultimately feel good, to your point. So I like that one, Steve. Next one going to come from Anthony, our guy. Greetings and salutations, Nikias and Steve. Hope all is well with you guys. Continued success. Had a good time watching you guys for Heat Pacers this past weekend. My questions are for the both of you and your perspective on the season so far. So first question from Anthony. While it's early, what's the most interesting thing you're seeing from the league strategically, whether it be how teams are employing schemes defensively or any particular wrinkles offensively that may have caught your eye so far? Going to hang up and listen.
Full court pressure for me. All the teams going with full court pressure. Let's try and get you to start your sets late. Offense is countering by having someone else try and bring up the court. Defense is countering by having that person be pressured as well. But that's probably been the one thing that's popped out to me the most. That's number one for me. What about you, Nikias?
Well, thank goodness I had a couple of things in the notes. Because number one for me was the full court pressure rate, which, once again, cite, 5 years ago, the league average for full court pressure possessions was about 12 per game. This year, that is up to 24. And actually, earlier in the season, that was around 26, so that number's still going down. But that is still roughly double the rate that we saw even 5 years ago, and a massive increase from the 16.7 possessions per game we saw last year. So that's probably number one. As far as offense is concerned, just looking at some of the trends statistically, pick and roll rate continues to decline. We are seeing more handoffs, and something that you have pointed to a lot, Steve, as we talked about different teams over the past couple seasons, just the increase in pass and cut, or the increase in handoffs. Like, we are starting to see, I guess, a subtle shift to that versus pure pick and roll, especially as switch rate across the league is up. So watching those guys, watching people, I talked about Detroit earlier this year. Hey, let's just flash a big to the middle of the floor. Let's go into a handoff on the other side, or We get a flash tossed to this guy. Here's a cut. This is something that you've talked about with Kat and Jalen Brunson in particular. So, like, seeing that as a counter to some of the switching and some of the pressure that we're seeing, if you're going full court pressure, if you're just trying to top lock and be physical off the ball, all right, let's just have someone flash to the middle of the floor, and then we can play pass and cut off of that. So that would be the other thing that I would add, but I'm glad that we're in alignment that the full court pressure rate has been interesting to see across the league. And I'm curious to see, like, what that number is actually going to end up at. I mean, 26 early in the year. I think last time we talked about it was around 25. Is it 24 right now? It feels like it's going to be over 20 possessions per game at the very least. So curious to see where that number lands, but there we go. And then as a bonus from Anthony, what has been each of your favorite five-man lineups to watch so far?
I mean, I'll go first. I'm pretty boring with it. Boston, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Derek White, Jrue Holiday, Al Horford. I enjoy that. The Cavs starting five, the Knicks starting five. The Magic starters when Paolo was healthy. It was fun to watch. Mm-hmm. The Thunder small ball unit with Jalen Williams at the center and just insert Shea plus wings and et cetera. Pretty ideal. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Those are probably the ones for me. What about you?
Okay. For me, I'll get the hipster pick out of the way early, I suppose.
If you're going to say the Nets, I swear, I'm gonna take my headphones off.
Okay. Well, it is indeed the Brooklyn Nets. When they go to their hybrid second unit of Dennis Schroeder, Zaire Williams, Jalen Wilson, Noah Clowney, and Nicholas Claxton, they've been outscored by a singular point in 34 minutes so far this year. But per NBA.com, it's a 104.3 defensive rating, which is insane. PvP stats has a different number around 112. So that's either a top three defense or a top 10 defense. Either way, that group has been really good when on the floor together defensively at the very least. And I think they are a very loud example of the full court press revolution that we've seen in the NBA. Those five guys get after.
How many minutes they played together?
34.
Bet.
So, yeah, minus 434 minutes. Like that, to that point, that is the only lineup that I have in my notes that has, like, they have lost their minutes so far. And again, it's by a singular point, so we'll take that. Fred VanVleet, Dylan Brooks, Amen Thompson, Tari Eason, Şengün. They're plus 18 and 14 minutes. That is just a whole lot of defense around Şengün. We just talked about the Houston Rockets on the last episode of Pod. So circle back if you would like. But that group's been fun, particularly defensively. The Memphis Grizzlies, talked about them earlier in the year, but like when they actually just had Santi Aldama at the three, like it made me laugh, but also, hey, this is a lot of size. And like, these are still bigs that can do stuff. So Ja, Jalen, Wells, Santi Aldama, Jaren Jackson Jr., Zach Edey was an interesting lineup to pop early in the season. Naturally, Ja's still out right now. Memphis just dealing with a lot of injuries, but still producing well. That group, a plus 18 in 34 minutes, Steve. And then the last one I would add, also a Thunder example. Hadn't got to see a lot of it, and now we just won't see it since Chet is out. But Shea, Lou Dort, Alex Caruso, Jalen Williams, Chet Holmgren, a plus 11 to 9 minutes. That is your ideal closing lineup, in my opinion. Just get your best defenders out there. You got Chet, you got Shea, you got Jalen. Like, you just have a whole lot of fun with that group. So, haven't seen a lot of it, want to see more. But I have enjoyed it when it's been out there.
I would like to circle back to this Brooklyn Nets lineup that you threw at me.
Okay.
What's their offense look like when those players play together?
Oh, it's bad. It is bad.
What are your offense philosophies? See, here's the problem. Here's the problem, folks. I'll peel the curtain back. I retain too much information in my head. So I am receiving dual messages here. Tell me sell me on this group offensively, Nikias.
Oh, I'm not going to pretend to sell you on the group offense. Like, the basis of me liking the lineup is that I like when they're on defense. That's the whole bit. So, offensively, it is a whole lot of Dennis Schroeder. Like, you get Durant. Like, I will say, like, the grab and go from Nick Claxton or Noah Clowney is cool. Like, it's like the bigs being able to display their versatility. But in the half court, it's rough. Like, it is Dennis Schroeder hit shots, Jalen Wilson random drive, or it gets kind of hazy. Nick Claxton also tagged Noah Clowney would shoot a bunch of threes, but teams don't really guard him out there like that. So, like, the half-court offense is absolutely hazy. I'm not about to make the argument. Like, the offense is the reason why they have been, again, by a point, but they have been outscored in their minutes together. The defense is the selling point for me.
I don't think you like them that much.
Okay, fair enough. I'll take the pushback. That's cool. That's cool. But those would be the lineups that I will toss out there. So, thank you, Anthony. Next question going to come from JP, who says, hello, hello. How insane would NBA discourse be if teams only had 17 games a year and a week between games for yapping? I think about this in the context of how we talk about breakout games where a young player shakes his die and gets a high roll. Highlight channels in the discourse will cheer him rolling a six, but will be silent about games where he rolled low. But what's more important to you when you're evaluating a young player? The player revealing that a high number exists on his die, or the average of his rolls that includes his ones and twos? P.S. Sorry if this is the Kevin Durant versus Al Horford Rookie of the Year debate all over again.
Good question. I think both are important. I think for a young player to see that they can hit a certain level is key. Obviously, you'd like to see consistency. And I think when you evaluate someone, you got to go over the course of the season. And so we've seen players grow into roles where at the start, you're seeing kind of the bursts and the drives. Like I use Brandon Miller, for example. You saw pieces of what he ended up doing early. Didn't see the consistency with it. So it was like, okay, I like the drives, but what are you doing once you get there? I like this, what are you doing when you get there? But as the season goes on, they start to improve on that. Now, maybe those high points that stood out become a part of what they do. And so everything kind of blends together in a way. I don't think you have to just salute the, you know, 20 and 10 point game. Like Zach Edey, let's say, for example, Zach Edey making threes. I don't necessarily think the three ball is part of his package. I don't stamp that on him, but the fact that he can feels important. I'd say the same thing for like Donovan Clingan. Is he going to make every three? No. But the fact that it's in the bag somewhere, I'm intrigued. So, okay. If you combine the fact that the defense is holding up, the activity is there, there's some scheme versatility, and it's not just pick and roll, it could space him. Okay, that makes it a little bit more intriguing, if that makes sense. So I don't think you have to necessarily live and die by their worst moments. I do think you have to kind of highlight some of the good things, understand the pattern, and then see where the ceiling takes them.
Okay, I really like that answer. I think for me, it kind of depends on like the prospect profile. Like I think for some, like an older rookie, we'll use Dalton Connect as an example. Like I would probably value, like the floor a little bit more. Like I would want a level of consistency as I am expecting you to be more NBA ready, quote unquote. And so I'd probably be looking at that part first. As far as like your 18, 19 year old, like a high variance prospect that you are already going to be waiting on, I do want to see some of those flashes to Steve's point. So like I'm looking more for like, okay, what does the high end look like? If they do put it together, what kind of game should I be expecting? And then you're building the level of consistency from there as they get more experience, as they build out the body, et cetera, et cetera. Overall, I also agree with Steve. Like, obviously, both are going to be important. Like, in a perfect world, you don't just want either a six or a one or a two, if we're working off of this example. But, like, if it is going to be a low-end game, like, how good is that low-end game? If it's a high-end game, like, what can I see here? What's replicable? So both are important. I think depending on, like, the age, experience level of the prospect is kind of where I'm giving a little bit more grace. If you are younger, like, okay, let's see how high this peak is and how much of that can be built on for the older guys. Like the ceiling's still going to be important because that's where you get some of the true breakout potential. This is where, I guess if you want to use like a Desmond Bane as an example, it's where he slid in part because of like wingspan stuff, but also more established prospect. But then he continues to grow and it's like, oh, this is like legit all-star potential here. This is a little bit different. And you take that. But I do prioritize things based on like what, you know, experience level they're coming in with, if that makes sense.
Nikias against age, shocker.
You know, I walked right into that one. I can't even.
Sure did.
I can't even be upset. That's deeply, deeply unfortunate. All right. Well, moving on. Next question going to come from Shay, who says, hi, Nikias and Steve. Love the podcast. Keep it up. I have a few questions regarding spacing. First question, you guys talk about how spacing isn't just shooting, that there are other ways to create space, such as cutting, for example. Can you guys elaborate on this? As I would think that cutting into a packed paint isn't that much of an advantage.
Well, no, blindly cutting into a packed paint probably isn't an advantage, but you have to just kind of think about and reconsider how you can flip things on a defense with how you space the floor. Let's say you have maybe a non-shooter or a non-shooting guard, and a team decides to put like Donovan Mitchell or Stephen Curry on him. Let's put that guard at the dunker spot. Now that low help is a small guard. That is a simple way to impact what a defense does or can do or might react just by how you space the floor. So I think when everyone thinks spacing, they think five out or the floor is all clean. It's not always that. Let's think about empty side pick and roll action with two of your best players on that first right wing. The other side is your third best player. You have to make a decision. That is spacing. When we talk about cutting, it's not necessarily, it's the timing of the cut. If you time your cut poorly, yes, you will help the defense out. You will allow someone to guard two people at once. If you time it well, you can now flip a defense's rotations. So if you have a side of the floor that has two, three guys on it, and you get a pick and roll, they're in rotation, someone cuts at the right time, now what the defense anticipated to be a rotation to the corner is no longer there. That's a good way for cutting to create an advantage for your team. A lot of teams, if you watch, especially OKC did a lot of this last year, but a whole bunch of teams do this. Right side has someone in the corner, has someone on the wing. We're about to run pick and roll. That wing cuts and clears. That's going to give that guard more space to attack that right side, more time to hold the big, more time to hold the defense, put more pressure on the defense. So cutting is not the end all be all, but cutting can give you that advantage. It's not necessarily just about getting the back cut to score. It's about kind of manipulating the defense a little bit. So I would throw that out there.
Oh, that's really good stuff. And like, I think even removing cutting for a minute, like I think like where you spacing guys matter. Like Steve, you had a great example with moving a guard to the dunker spot to kind of stress out help rotations and make those decisions a little bit more difficult, make the rim attacks more fruitful from the offensive side, even just where you're putting your big. Like going back to the Heat Pacers game that we did, like, hey, here's Miles Turner on the opposite wing. There's a big guarding him. Do you want to help or not? You're putting the defensive big that wants to gravitate to the paint. You're on the perimeter. You're doing so from the opposite slot. Okay, the help may be a little bit more complicated now because I'm going against my own wiring as a defensive big. It doesn't feel as fruitful now as teams have just gotten more more comfortable helping off the strong side corner. But like one of the early hacks, you know, going back just a few seasons, we have a less than stellar shooter. Let's put him in the strong side corner since the general rule is we don't help from the strong side. Let's clear a little bit more space to get to another, you know, get to the other side of the floor if you want to with a drive or a pick and roll, whatever the case may be. But like even something as simple as that is a way to kind of manipulate the floor and kind of put a strain on help decisions for a defense. So like those would be the two that I would toss out since you've already nailed the other ones. But yeah, like it doesn't have to just be five out spacing. I think cutting is important. Where you're putting your guys, when they're getting to those spots are important. Like simple, one guy's in the corner as you're running the pick and roll. As the pick and roll happens, we're lifting to the wing. It's not necessarily a cut to the basket, but you are making help decisions tougher with that timely relocation and lifting up higher on the floor. So like there are different ways that you can get to fruitful looks offensively. And the second question, the Cavs are able to play two or three non-shooters at times by having one of them, usually Evan Mobley, bring the ball up and operate on the ball more. Do you think the Chicago Sky can do something similar with Angel Reese, or would that reduce her effectiveness as one of her major skills is rebounding? And I can see this role putting her away from the basket.
Yes. And I think that's going to be kind of the fun of having a tremendous new coach, Angel Reese being able to play unrivaled and develop some of the spacing or on the ball skills to be able to attack. I think we saw growth last year from Angel Reese with the drives. Now, does that turn into dribble handoffs and rolls? If you're the Sky and you have two bigs, you can kind of have some fun with being able to use both of them as screeners and handoff hubs and rollers and kind of go from side to side. And they'll kind of have to have that yin-yang effect. I don't know if you have to have Angel bring the ball up to get some of that, if that makes sense. But The better that she kind of develops the drive and the attack kind of opens up what you can do. You can run some inverted pick and roll. You can kind of move her off the ball, kind of have her come off screens if she develops in that way. I don't think it would reduce her ability to rebound. I think that's kind of an innate skill that she has. But I do think it would. The better they're able to get those bigs to be more mobile, work together in those ways, the better that offense is going to be. So I kind of think it's not going to be apples to apples, but I think it would be a good goal.
I like it. Like, I think to bounce off of that, the Sky already experimented with, like, they've already used Angel as a handoff hub, and I would imagine, like, Tyler will want to expand on that. As far as bringing the ball up, like, that inspired me to naturally look this up. So it went second spectrum surfing, and then the quick caveat there with the W data is that, you know, the games are logged where they have the camera set up. So, like, the first couple of home games for the Sparks, they weren't in their home arena, so you don't have those games. I think all of Angel's games are logged except the one against the Aces where they were at T-Mobile Arena instead of the Aces regular home game. So we do have 33 of the 34. So within that, you know, within that context, she logged 75 trips of bringing the ball up the floor per second spectrum, 0.93 points per possession on those trips, which is a little bit below like Chicago's normal offensive efficiency. But like it is a little bit of proof of concept that they've at least given her the freedom to grab a rebound and go. And so it wouldn't surprise me if, with an offseason of training, to Steve's point, with Unrivaled getting to test out more of the drives and stuff, like, do we start to see some of those Evan Mobley-esque, like, inverted screens just to kind of test out the defense, see what they want to do? Not that she's going to run 10 pick and rolls a game, but maybe they allow her to experiment with, like, one or two. See if you get an early advantage. If you don't have it, she can then just flow into a handoff or just pass the ball to the opposite side of the floor and you can get into your offense however you want to go. So, like, the fact that she's already done some of that under Teresa Witherspoon, I think it's a little bit easier to build out that foundation and pump up the volume, especially if she does have a fruitful summer. Can't read too much into highlight workout videos, stuff like that, but she is working. So if you feel better about that, you can do more of that stuff. And to Steve's point, like, I think the rebounding is just going to be there regardless. I think in an ideal world, you want the offensive rebounds to drop anyway because you just want the offense to be better. More made shots naturally just means less offensive rebounding opportunities. And if you are leaving more of that space for Camilla inside the arc anyway, it wouldn't surprise me if there's an offensive rebound dip from Angel, period. That has nothing to do with how good she is or how she's being used and just more Camilla. I mean, she's going to get more of those opportunities. But if you beef up the offense, you get to see more of the defense shine. I think ultimately you just want the Sky to get better as a whole. But so I think that experimentation is going to be there. Moving on to the next question. It's going to come from Michael, who says, "Hey, y'all, I'm a diehard Bucks fan, born and raised in Milwaukee. And it's really sad that I don't get national media podcasts talking about Giannis. I hear more about Joel Embiid," shaking my head. "Sorry for the rant, but I love the NBA that much. Nevertheless, here's my point. Giannis is having one of the most efficient seasons ever. He dropped 41, 9, and 8 on 70% shooting tonight." That was last night as of recording. "And he's at 61% on the season. Mind you, he's taking 21 shots a game at a 61% clip. No other superstar ever could take that many shots and keep that same efficiency while playing elite defense. Here's a few examples from prime seasons below. Luka Doncic in 2024, 23 shots per game on 42% shooting from the field. Joel Embiid from 2023, 22 shots on 53% shooting. Nikola Jokic from this year, 19 shots on 56% shooting. Kevin Durant from 2021, 20 shots on 51% shooting. LeBron James from 2017, 19 shots on 54% shooting. Can we please discuss the season Giannis is having on both ends?"
Sure. Great question, Michael. I'm sure I'm going to let you down here very quickly. Number one, we can sum up your research a little bit quicker, because last year, Giannis Antetokounmpo was the first player in NBA history to average 30 points a night on 60% shooting in a season. Mm-hmm. This season, Giannis is on track to become the second time, averaging 31 points, shooting 60% from the field, 12 rebounds, 6 assists. So he's been insane offensively. I don't necessarily feel like I have to compare what he does to what other superstars do, because no one's done what Giannis has done, literally, mm-hmm. in the history. This isn't even like a Kareem thing, Adrian Dantley. Like, he's the first one. We have not seen this. So that kudos to Giannis. He's incredible. Now, when you say while playing elite defense, this is where you may have come to the wrong spot. He can find pockets where the defense is there, but if he was truly playing that elite level of defense, the Bucks would likely be a little bit better defensively, in my opinion. And so they found it. I think we've seen him do more switching as the season has gone on. I think his weak side rotations, when locked in, are pretty good. But at this stage of the game, because of how much of effort is going on the offensive end, I don't necessarily know if we get the same Giannis that we've seen defensively before in the past. Mm-hmm. So I will just drop that nugget. He's been very, very good. And he should be in the hashtag conversation. Mm-hmm. But I did want to say that.
Well, I think that's fair. Just to bounce off of that, career high in scoring right now for Giannis, converting nearly 63% of his twos, only shooting 18% from three. But this is the first time since his second season in the league in which he is averaging under a three-point attempt per game. He is very much getting inside the arc. We're seeing the middies. Big spot at the end of the Charlotte game not too long ago. I'm getting to the minis, but he's really attacking the basket quite a bit. Also, career low in free throw percentage right now. That certainly has to bounce back, because if it does, we're looking at, what, 33, 34 points per game for Giannis if he gets the free throw shooting under control. So, to that point, like, he has been dominant inside the arc. To the defense point, Steve already nailed it, so I'm not going to hang here too long. He just has to do so consistently. But we know what he can do in space. We know what he can do at the rim. But just some numbers on that front. As of recording, Milwaukee's defense has been better with Giannis off the floor so far, and that is despite opponents shooting nearly 41% from three with him off the floor. Generally, when you get a weird split like that from a person you think is really good at defense, and still is, Giannis is a good defender. I'm not making that case that he isn't. But normally when you have like the weird stat like that, it's because team is just bombing away from three wildest players on the court, and then they're missing all the threes when he's on the bench, and so that just leads to disparity. The fact that that is flipped and the defense is still better without Giannis is at least concerning from a, you know, from a statistical point of view. Team shooting 52.3% inside the arc with Giannis on the floor. That drops to 48.1% with him off. And so, again, that isn't all Giannis. Like, on-off stuff will never just be one person. But for someone that has won Defensive Player of the Year before, and to Steve's point, when he ramps it up, is still just one of the most terrifying defenders in the league. You want a little bit more consistency. You want him to be a driver of that elite defense. Milwaukee, 18th overall, 12th in half-court defense right now per Clean the Glass. So you want a little bit more from Giannis on that front. And with him, specifically in pick and roll, 1.05 points per possession on any trip featuring a pick and roll defended by Giannis right now. That is the highest number allowed by him in 5 years. Also worth noting, switched nearly 38% of picks last year. That is down to 17% this year. This is something that Steve talked about when we had Ty Windish on the floor, on the pod not too long ago. He's certainly been in a drop. So, yeah, you just want a little bit more. He is still one of the best two-way forces in the league. We know what he can be defensively. He generally has a high floor just because of the size and length and that kind of deterrence factor. But he does have to ramp it up to kind of match what we know he can be. Moving back to Blue Sky with some questions from T-Dub. On the Sacramento Kings, do they have the goods for a playoff run as is and are simply battling the injury bug? Or do they need a trade to make the most of De'Aaron Fox's prime? Who do you foresee as potential trade partners or targets for them?
They just got DeMar. They just got DeMar, right? Am I bugging?
No, they did.
Well, okay. I do not think the Sacramento Kings have to make a trade right now. I think Sacramento gotten the offense back on track. Defense somewhere in the middle. You'd probably like it to be a little bit stronger. Injuries don't make it fun. Now, the irony is they don't have the wins that would make you feel like this is more of a success than it's been. I think they've had a lot of good moments. I think they've had a lot of strong moments. They've shown an ability to guard. Offensively, they can put a lot of pressure on you. 2-point loss to Minnesota, 4-point loss to the Lakers, 3-point loss to Toronto in overtime, a couple bad ones, 4-point loss to Minnesota in overtime, 1-point loss to Atlanta. That's 5 of their 7 losses. Which is similar refrain to last year, which is kind of funny considering what they made the move for. But this is not like the sky is falling quite yet. I can't get there. So I don't think there's a player or an archetype that would boost them right now. I think you got to hopefully get healthy, let your big three settle and continue to grind throughout the Western Conference. Because if you're 14th in defensive rating, or 16th in defensive rating, and you're 6th in offensive rating, you probably take that formula, hope the defense gets better, and try and continue to win in the West, as opposed to swinging for the fences again.
I got you. Like, I think looking at this season, at the very least, like, this is just much more I want to see the full complement. Yeah, again, a lot of close losses, but they have just been good overall. Zooming out, like in a vacuum, like I still do kind of feel fuzzy about And I do feel kind of fuzzy about like the four spot for Sacramento within a playoff context. Because that's either going to be like Keegan or like nominally DeMar. And so like what that's going to mean defensively alongside Sabonis as they have to face like an OKC or, you know, if Golden State keeps this up and the amount of pressure they can just put on you on both ends of the floor. So like I do just have like general questions for me to put them comfortably in like tier one as a contender when healthy. So I guess to the heart of the question, like I think they will have to do something else eventually, but like I'm certainly not doing that now. Like I want to get want them to get healthier, give them room to like prove me wrong on that front.
Okay, I'm gonna raise my hand.
Okay.
So who's in tier one?
Tier one for me, I think based on what we've seen so far, like I think it's okay. I think OKC, Golden State, like the healthy Phoenix is really good. But I think out west they'll be I'd say OKC, Golden State. In the East, like this Boston and Cleveland would probably be like the four if I'm just trying to narrow it down.
No, we're good. We'll keep it Western Conference. Who's in tier two in the West?
Feels like a whole lot of teams could be in tier two. This is just the really good team, but big question mark division for me. So like to your point, like Phoenix, but will they stay healthy? Slash kind of eyeing the center room. The Lakers, you have LeBron and AD. What exactly is this defense ultimately going to be? Feels like a very fair question to ask. Like Memphis has been good, but what version of healthy will they actually be? Slash, the bench has certainly stepped up when everyone's in their normalized role. Will they continue that consistency? And to your point, Steve, like what does the late game offense look like with this group? Want to make sure I'm not forgetting it. Oh, duh, Dallas. When you get Luka back, they get to the full complement. Like they were just in the finals. So like Dallas, healthy Dallas is probably like tier 1.5 for me. Or tier one if I want to give them just the full respect from being a finals team last year. But like Dallas also being in the discussion.
So, everybody in tier two. Shout out to Houston fans and Minnesota fans that are yelling at you in your car.
Again, I didn't want to forget
folks. Doing their bench press, drinking their coffee. Et cetera, et cetera.
Man, Denver got Jokic, Minnesota. So they're trying to sort out like the elite defense, but Anthony Edwards seems to have taken a step up.
Are you taking this as a challenge to name every team?
I'm not. Stop it now. I'm just
stop. 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 You're fine. Right, they're not going to yell at you. You're beloved. You got all the Nakia Maniacs. Don't worry about it. Nakia Maniacs.
We'll let that rock. Okay. Any more Kings thoughts? Want to make sure.
Nah.
Give you room. Okay. Fair enough. Well, speaking of one of these Western Conference teams, this one's going to come from Mad Salary Man, which fantastic name. But roughly 16 games into the season, the Grizzlies are number three in pace at roughly 104. What are some things that you see that contribute to this?
What's your theory, Nikias?
I think for me, it is a combination of we forced turnovers before Ja got hurt. Ja being back was a figurative and literal driver of them playing a little bit faster and getting out and running. And the fact that they just have multiple bodies they can grab and go. So like that would probably be my quick answer. Ja returned, we can force turnovers. Also, like if Jaren can grab the ball and push the ball up the floor and then advance it, Santi Aldama will lead a break. Than any of their guards or wings. I think just the randomness of that kind of helps juice the pace for them.
Yeah, I think just being a little bit healthier in pockets has allowed that. I think they were eighth in 2022-23, so it's not surprising. I think, as you mentioned, the emergence of Jaren Jackson Jr. having more freedom to push off misses is huge. I think the way they're set up defensively to show help when they get those stops or force those turnovers, they're out of there. So I think that just kind of contributes to it. Their defense being a little bit more solid to start the season as opposed to some like the normal ramp up. They get stops, they run, they go. That's kind of how the Grizzlies have gone. So that's about it for me.
Here you go. And to that point, off from cleaning the glass, the Grizzlies third. In transition frequency, about 18.3% of their possessions, slightly behind OKC at 18.4. And Steve, do you know who's number one in transition frequency this year?
I do not.
It is the Denver Nuggets. would not have had that one on the bingo card heading into the year.
Gotta believe in Russ.
There you go. The Russ effect. And then specifically pushing off of misses, so off of live rebounds, the Grizzlies sixth in frequency there. So to the point, again, if you're able to get those stops, defense is 30, you're able to run, and because they have a variety of players that they are comfortable with bringing the ball up and ultimately advancing and attacking early, they can just get to the transition game a little bit quicker, figuratively and literally. So thank you for the question there. Next one to come from Imad, who says, having shockingly just found out that Donovan Mitchell and Jalen Brunson are the same age, who would you rather have in the existing Cavs and Knicks roster? A little Donovan Mitchell, Jalen Brunson free throw. I like it.
You ready for my answer?
Sure.
I would prefer Donovan Mitchell on the Cavs and Jalen Brunson on the Knicks.
Huh, well, there you go. Okay. Which I probably say same. Within that context, if we do just go with the basic, hey, Donovan Mitchell or Jalen Brunson, who would you rather have? Like, just in a vacuum, who would you pick in that scenario?
Stephen Curry.
Okay. You <don't... laughs> You got it. Donovan versus Jalen is a tough one, man. Because, like, what Jalen does inside the arc should not be possible at the volume that he does it. Gets to the line a bunch, too. Really good finisher. Like, I probably slightly lean Donovan because of some of the defensive upside, the plus wingspan. Like, we have seen him guard up at times. Probably, like, Donovan in seven for me. But as far as the team context goes, like, I'm with you. Like, everyone should just stay where they're at. Next pair of questions going to come from Alexander, who says, hi, hello, and greetings. First off, I just want to say how much I love this pod and how much I learned from you. Specifically, as I started following the W more closely this past season, the ongoing league-wide coverage was great, but having listened to the pod previously gave me a sense of who was who and what was what that made it much easier to find my feet. So thank you. My first question is incredibly Dekaius coded. You both talk a lot about how willing Boston is to screen up and down the roster and the advantages they generate when, say, Tatum and White screen for each other. Can you talk a bit about the quality of those screens? Are they generating those advantages just because teams give up soft switches, or are they setting superior picks that would force switches no matter what? And can you power rank the Celtics top 10, i.e. the starting five, Kristaps and Pritchard, Sam Hauser, Luke Kornet, and Demias Kata, by their prowess as screeners relative to their league-wide peers?
Oh, yeah, you're going to be here a minute. Hold on, yeah, I'll be back. Get some water or something.
That's crazy. That is to say, obviously, on absolute terms, Kata's screens are more effective than Pritchard's. He has about a foot and 70 pounds on him. Rather, are the effectiveness of Pritchard's screens relative to other small guards greater or lesser than the effectiveness of Kata's screens relative to other seven-footers? So, one, thank you for the love, and thank you for this question. I will say, this led me spending either way too much time on this question or the expected time that I would spend on this question, which is why you posed this to me to begin with. So naturally, it just starts with thinking about Boston's screening setup. And as you mentioned, Derek White screening for Jason Tatum, Drew Holiday screening for Jason Tatum and pick and roll, you know, feeding matchups to those wings, Derek White screening for Jaylen Brown, you know, the pin downs that they'll go to where they'll have the guard screening for Tatum or Brown on either side of the floor. And then I just got kind of stuck thinking about like the league-wide portion of the program, because my base question became, what level of, I guess, like grading curve was I going to give the guards? Because naturally bigs are going to screen more frequently than guards because of the size and the physical advantages they can create. But it just feels like the dearth of guard screeners, like I think the volume is increasingly wide, but it still doesn't reach the bigs. So I was just trying to figure out in my head how I wanted to balance that portion of the program. To answer like the effectiveness first, like I think there are elements of both in which teams are like, we're going to switch to flatten out Boston. Like we saw in that Cleveland game that we talked a little bit about. Hey, let's just switch all this stuff, make them go one-on-one, hope to bog them down. So there is a little bit of that. But I do really appreciate just how much screening talent this roster has overall. Like Jason Tatum, you know, you will use him as a screener to kind of engineer some of these switches. This is something that Steve has talked about a lot, and you are a listener, so you know that. But Tatum does have really good timing as he's getting out if teams are trying to switch. He does a really good job of, let me get a little bit of contact, let me hit this screen at an angle, let me hold my position to make sure that this is going to be a switch, even if you do want to go like show and recover or something. I can hold my spot and then I can attack quickly, or once I know that I have the switch that I want, I can now face up, get into my jab series, do whatever I want to do from there. So I do think there are like some technical aspects that Jason Tatum's really good at. Derek White doesn't mind getting full contact. Jrue Holiday doesn't mind getting full contact. Derek White, Andrew, like, they are really good at flipping the angle of the screens. Like, this is something that, and we're going to get into Luke Kornet, but that's probably the thing that I appreciate the most about Luke Kornet. He does set solid contact. He does have a really good sense for angles, but he is really good at flipping the angle of the screen at the last moment and doing so without getting hit with illegal screens. And so, again, to that point, like, they do a really good job of, well, most of the roster, we'll get to the list, but they do really, really good job of like the technical aspect of screening. In addition to, we got a whole bunch of talent, so teams might just want to switch this stuff anyway. As far as the rankings go, I did land at Luke Kornet number one. I'm not going to bore you with all of these specific numbers from Second Spectrum, and shout out to Second Spectrum for actually tracking screening data. But Luke Kornet, number one for me, very high up in contact rate on screens, on and off the ball, high points per possession amounts when he's involved as a screener on and off the ball. And again, as I mentioned, his ability to flip the angle at the last moment, like, really does it for me. Like, trying to ice a screen against the Boston Celtics is just futile, especially when Luke Kornet's involved, because he will pry whoever the ball handler is open. They will be able to lead the dance. So I do have Luke Kornet number one. I have Derek White number two. The off-ball screening work is really good, and it helps set up some really quick advantages for Jason Tatum, for Jaylen Brown, when he's involved in like some of those down screens or pin downs, or even when they go to like some of their ram action to set up another pick and roll. Like, Boston will invert that sometimes and use Derek White. It's like that initial screener to pry Jason Tatum up. But Derek White, really good at the little things. He can flip the angle, knows when to slip, doesn't mind getting his hands dirty with actual contact. And if he does get the ball, naturally he can make the short roll reach you need him to, has a floater that he likes, can get all the way to the basket, can make passing reads from there. So Luke Kornet one, Derek White two. I have Jason Tatum number three. To dip into the data a little bit, he is second on the Celtics in terms of pick and roll and off-ball screen contact rate. So he lays the lumber. And again, like, the timing of some of his screens when he's trying to engineer those switches, can turn those into switches to attack, or can slip into open space and get downhill. So really like what Jason Tatum does. Jrue Holiday four for me. Mr. Kata, I have five. Who I think, just in terms of pure, will this guy get contact? Like, he would probably be number one for me, but he is pretty high up in terms of illegal screen contact rate or illegal screen rate. A high percentage of his screens compared to the rest of the roster does end in a whistle and the ball going the other way. So I have to ding him a little bit there, especially once you're comparing it league-wide to other bigs. So he slips a little bit behind Jrue. Kristaps after that. Peyton Pritchard. Sam Hauser. Lowest contact rate on the team. But naturally, he's just ghosting a lot of those. It is worth noting that when he does get contact, he will absolutely force a switch. So like, the actual screen contact to die on screen ratio is really high for him. And then last on the list for me would be Jaylen Brown, who his screening is mostly to let me get this switch. And I think that's where you see a lot of the soft switching in particular with Jaylen Brown, to get those matchups for him to attack. He is really effective at that, like, in terms of the, you know, points per possession when he is the on-ball screener, very high up. I think it's second on the roster. So effective, but his actual screening, I think, lags behind some of his teammates. So that would be my order. Luke Kornet, Derek White, Jason Tatum, Al Horford. That's the guy that I missed. So Horford at four, Jrue at five, Nemeas Kata at six, Kristaps at seven, Peyton Pritchard at eight, Sam Hauser nine, Jaylen Brown 10. And I will quickly note that Xavier Tillman leading the Celtics in screen contact rate. So I know he wasn't mentioned in the question, but I did want to at least say his name. And that concludes my screening talk. Very funny that at the end of this email question, in parentheses, it says, "Okay, Steve, you can come back now," as Steve actually returns to the recording station. So, Steve, welcome back, brother. How are we doing?
What?
Yeah.
What?
We got bona fide screening talk on the podcast.
No! What was that? This is Drew Holiday erasure.
Is it?
Yes!
Where would you have Drew Holiday?
Higher than you did. And Xavier Tillman, we ain't seen that man play in 8 days.
Hey, listen, I had Drew fifth.
Luke Kornet, number one.
He's an elite screener, absolutely. I don't know if Steve has been more disappointed on the pod than he is right now.
Jaylen Brown is dead last.
Yeah.
He only screens for one purpose. And it works.
Exactly.
So how's he last?
Because there has to be a little bit more screening variety. Also, the screens have to be a little bit better. You know what I mean?
Nikias, there is a league-wide mandate on positioning of screens.
Yeah,
what are you talking about?
It's also worth noting that he is not used frequently as a screener at all. So, like, there's also just a lack of volume with him that kind of hurts him in this kind of discussion. But, yeah.
I'm going to let you have that, buddy.
All right. Well, there we go. We did it. So after the okay, Steve, you can come back now. All right. Second question is about Denny Avdija, essentially asking, as Alexander is now on the West Coast, now that Denny's on the West Coast, doesn't get to watch as much. What have we seen from Denny Avdija this season, both in terms of his own development and in how the Blazers are using him? Is there still a chance he takes another step forward, or at this point he is who he's going to be? Is Portland a place where that could happen, or are they too disjointed and have higher priorities?
I think the thing for me with Denny, I don't have any real complaints about what Denny's done. I think it's just interesting to see. I don't know what his best context would be because he was in Washington with a bunch of volume shooters and he went to Portland, who also has a bunch of volume shooters. So does his impact get muted by that? Can you use him in the ways you want to use him? Or will the ball go other places, as kind of mentioned? So for me, that's kind of where I'm keeping my eye on it, because I don't think Denny's done. Like, I wouldn't say, well, he's only this, you know, because he's solid. He's good. I think you would want the shot to be at a higher level from three. That's probably the disappointing part. But he's got a blend of playmaking and versatility that should pop in this era. I think it's just about finding the ideal home or carving out something that you know you can expect every single night.
I think with me for Denny, like, something that I've said on the pod a bunch is, like, I can't wait to see him on, like, an actual good team, because I think he is a really good, like, punisher of advantages and someone that can just maintain advantages in the half court when someone already tilts it. And, like, Portland isn't the context for that exactly. And, like, the weird thing this season is that, I don't know, like, in a way it's similar because Washington also didn't have, like, your pure bona fide, like, top 10 number one option either. But it does feel like, well, I guess related to that, like, he's not getting the advantages to take advantage of. So you're not getting the best version of Denny. On top of that, it's also just felt like a lot of Denny at times. Denny has tried to create quite a bit and it just has not gone well. Like, he's not seeing, if we go to some numbers, like, he's not seeing the same number switches. He's seeing more drop than he ever has. And I think you're seeing where the next step for him as a pick and roll creator in particular is. Like, he has to get more comfortable in the middle of the floor. Like, he has to have a comfortable pull-up two that he can get to, or a comfortable floater he can get to. And, like, something that I joked about not too long ago, we were watching the Wizards in the watch party. Come join us for those. It's like watching him in transition and teams are just kind of sitting on the Euro step from him. And I was like, oh, well, this is the, you know, something that Steve's hammered home. Like, once you get good, defenses do adjust. And now you got to make the next adjustment, the counter adjustment to that. So, like, teams sitting on that Euro step, like, I think the finishing has just been, it's felt weird. And then looking up the actual numbers inside the arc for him, it's even worse than I thought. And, like, part of that is just, again, like, some scouting report adjustments, like, we know what hand he wants to get to. We know what kind of move he wants to get to inside the arc. Some of that is just depending on who he's paired with. Like, if he's sharing the floor with, like, Scoot and Delano Banton, like, naturally the paint's going to be crowded. Or, like, your center room right now, like, Robert Williams just got back, but Donovan Clingan, like, he's not spacing the floor for you. DeAndre Ayton comfortable in the mid-range, but he's not spacing the floor for you to that same degree. paint's a little crowded. The finishing hasn't been there. Looking it up on Bleacher Report this morning. Bleacher Report. Looking it up on Basketball Reference this morning. I saw a notification, so I saw that's a good bit. But looking it up on Basketball Reference, Denny converting 44% of his shots inside of 3 feet. His previous low was 63.3% in year two. I do not believe Denny Avdija is a below 50% finisher at the rim. But when you get off to that kind of start, yeah, that's going to tank your efficiency. And then to the point about him, again, feel like he's trying to create a bunch. He's seeing more drop, et cetera. He's attempting to beat that coverage. It isn't working to the same degree. But his rate of unassisted baskets has skyrocketed this year. Only 40.2% of his inside the arc made field goals have been assisted. His previous low was at 53.8%. So before this year, over half of his twos were always assisted. More than half. That's below that nine this year. 61.5% of his threes are assisted. His previous low was 85.2. So trying to get, trying to beat the drop, I guess would be the way to quickly sum that up. And it hasn't gone super well. Finishing hasn't been the same. There's more congestion in the paint. Hasn't knocked down shots in the middle of the floor. And three ball hasn't been there. I think if you get him more to being able to cut, or at the very least, let's get some pressure downhill with like Scoot or someone else. Now we can tilt it. Now we can get it to Denny against a tilted defense. He may have more success. I do think the finishing is going to perk back up. The shooting should be better. I don't know what the level is going to be. Because like, even when he's knocked down shots in Washington, teams haven't treated him like a knockdown guy. But yeah, like I think overall, I just wish he was in a situation to where he more consistently got to attack tilted defenses. Like that just isn't Portland right now. And related to that, like, I don't think Portland's going to be the place for him to figure that out. And not necessarily a disjointedness because some of the young guys, particularly Donovan Clingan, though that's a front court thing. Like they do have guys they enjoy. Like Steve just talked about Shaedon Sharpe on the last pod and some of the growth we've seen from him. Donovan Clingan's been very good as a rookie. We're going to do a rookie report soon. But yeah, like those guys are just going to be in higher order in terms of the priority than Denny is. And so I think it's still going to be Denny on like legitimate playoff team or contender for all of the off-ball things to really pop for him. Because the defense has been fine. But the offense has been a bit of an adventure so far. And then our last question from the mailbag from CLRNC on Blue Sky. If you could pick any player to watch film with, who would you choose and why?
LeBron James.
Tracks.
Kevin Durant, Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, Damian Lillard, James Harden.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you are all over my list. good gracious. Players on the list not mentioned so far. Chris Paul. I would love to watch some film with Chris Paul. I do wonder, like, what the film-watching experience with Luka would be like. Because I feel like he would either, like, really dig into this stuff, or it's just like, well, duh, that guy sunk. I did this. And it's one of those, like, he's so good at basketball, like, he might not be able to, like, you know, he might not go 10 minutes on what he saw. And it's just like, well, duh, why doesn't everybody do this? So I'm genuinely curious at, like, which side of the coin Luka would fall on. Chris Paul would be there. On the W side, like, I've gotten to do a little bit of that with Chelsea Gray, but like if I got like a full film session with Chelsea Gray, that'd be dope. Like Chelsea would be cool, Sabrina would be cool, Alyssa Thomas would be interesting, particularly on the defensive end. Like Neck would be someone I want to watch film with. Naturally, Asia would be someone I want to watch film with. Trying to think who else on the W side.
No Stewie.
Stewie, yeah, like I think Stewie is kind of like in the, especially since I've gotten to talk to Stewie a little bit with media stuff, like Stewie is kind of the Luka thing for me, to where like if we actually just got to sit down for 30 minutes, like I wonder like how much of this would just be, I have literally won everywhere, I've done everything, like this is just second nature to me stuff, versus let's get super bite-sized into these things. Not that she can't, but just like what the style is going to be. But like Stewie would be cool. Like, I have a similar question with Alyssa Thomas. So, like, to your point, like, I can add Stewart to the list as well. Actually, like, the passing reads with Caitlin be similar to the Chelsea Gray thing. But, like, hey, how and when did you see this passing read? I think it'd be cool to do something like that with Caitlin.
Oh, you're getting papped up, buddy. Am I?
For what?
They were open.
You know, see,
right away.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Fair's. I guess to circle back to the pod, like, you know, we've had Brittany Sykes on the pod. Like, actually getting to go through film with her, I think would be really interesting. Because, like, she was really insightful when we had her on and the way that she dug in on defense. So, like, getting to watch film with Brittany would be super cool as well. But, yeah, you already named the other names, like KD, LeBron. Like, defense stuff with Draymond would be really cool. But, yeah, listen. A lot of players.
I would add Diana Taurasi to the list.
Mm-hmm. Legend.
And I will trade all of them to Sue Bird.
There we go.
My list is complete.
All right. Well, there we go. There we go. Steve, I have a handful of free throws for you. If that is okay with you.
Fine.
All right. Well, circling back to Unrivaled, as we got the report from ESPN that Caitlin Clark would not be joining Unrivaled, but an open invite still does exist for her if she does. Steve, who would be your ideal two to round out the Unrivaled roster?
I got to pull the teams back up because I can cheat now and I know where the wild cards are.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you what, this is very free throw-ish of you. I just want you to know that.
Oh, my fault?
Let's
see. You want to swap this question out?
Nope, sure don't. Leave it where it's at. Benajelani Hamilton and Leo Fiebisch. There we go.
Oh, there we go. Just add some Liberty wings. Get some winners in the room. I feel you. Okay. Continue the free throws. We go back to the NBA side very quickly. Are you more worried about Tyrese Halliburton or Joel Embiid?
I'm not worried about either.
Okay.
I think Tyrese will get healthy and he'll be fine. And I think Embiid very quickly showed, you know, he scored 10 points in the first quarter last night. He'll be all right.
Okay, fair enough. How much should we care about LaMelo getting benched at the end of the the game earlier this week?
We shouldn't.
Okay.
Pressure your coach. You got to do what you got to do. Send a message.
Understand. There you go. Understand. More surprising, Detroit being a top 10 defense, Houston being a top 10 offense, or Memphis with all the injuries being top 10 in net rating?
You're not going to like my answer. None. I probably lean Houston. Didn't see them being able to pop at this level. Just talked about them on the last episode of the Dunk Spot. Watch on YouTube. That probably takes me for a surprise. Memphis, when you know, despite injuries, they have a style of play that can get you both of those. J.B. Bickerstaff is a good head coach. I'm not surprised he gets another team to defend. That was part of the idea of him being in there. So I'll just lean Houston.
Okay, fair enough. And then a trio of defensive questions for you. Better defensive season so far, OG Anunoby or Dyson Daniels?
Dyson, sure.
Okay. Victor Wembanyama or Anthony Davis?
AD.
Okay. Chris Dunn or Jalen Suggs?
The Mon! it's Jalen Suggs.
Okay, fair enough. Any closing basketball thoughts or questions?
I have free throws too, bud.
Oh, all right. What you got?
Better big three, Dallas or Milwaukee?
Dallas?
Better big three, New York or Cleveland?
New York or Cleveland? Ooh. So who would be the third for New York?
Pick, buddy.
You pick. I guess just based on how they play, it's got to be OG. Or Cleveland. I don't like that. I'll go Cleveland.
Okay. Better big three, Memphis or Minnesota?
Like, fully healthy? Is that the bit?
Yeah.
Okay. These are some tough ones. Darn.
You want to throw an unrivaled curveball at me. Now you got to deal with this.
What do you mean, curveball? I'll go Memphis.
Better big three, the Lakers or the Warriors?
It's the third, Dalton Connect. Kidding.
No, he's the fourth.
Get it? Fair enough.
Connect four.
That's a good shot.
Thank you.
Good
shot.
There you go. Or the, I guess it's the Lakers by default.
Okay. Better big three, the Magic or the Pacers?
It's got to be the Magic. At least right now.
Better big three, et cetera. Better big three, the Pelicans or the Heat?
I think it's fully healthy.
Yes.
Okay. Darn New Orleans. Get healthy, please. I'm going to say the Heat.
Better big three, the Nets or the Bulls?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Why would you do this to me?
Yeah.
I guess the Bulls, okay. But like...
stronger MVP case, De'Aaron Fox or Donovan Mitchell?
Stronger MVP case. Probably Fox. At least off the top of my head.
Stronger MVP case, LeBron James or Karl Anthony Towns?
That is disgusting. We'll go with LeBron James. Also, speaking of the Kings, from Chris Haynes, literally right now, DeMar DeRozan intends to make his return on Friday against the Los Angeles Clippers.
NBA Cup action on the way.
There we go.
Stronger MVP case, Giannis or Anthony Davis?
Well, it has to be probably Anthony Davis. Actually, yeah, it just kind of has to be Anthony Davis at the moment. For MVP, anyway.
Clutch player of the year, LaMelo Ball or Nikola Jokic?
That is going to be Jokic for me.
What are you going to do when the game's played hits?
Listen. If Jokic gets eliminated with games played stuff, well, I guess at that point, like, he wouldn't win anything or be awarded for anything, so, like, fine. But, like, it'd be very funny if, like, you know. That would be a very funny bit. No, the bit would just be I just move to a two-way player in the clutch. If LaMelo does get pulled from some defensive possession. Oh,
goodness gracious. All right. Who's the two-way? Who's the best defensive player in the league in the fourth quarter, Nikias?
Rowdy. Best defensive player in the clutch. I don't know. This still feels very like Caruso-coded. I ain't gonna hold you.
All right. That's all I got.
Okay, fair enough. Well then, with that being said, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. We are on the Young Man of the Three YouTube channel, formerly the JJ Reddit YouTube channel, every Tuesday. So subscribe if you want the video element for our opening episode of each week. We have play spliced in. We have graphics spliced in. You can see Steve shake his head when I say something ridiculous on the pod. So if that is more of your thing, come rock with us. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Nikias NBA. If you go through my following, you can find Steve. Just don't tell him.
Don't.
You know what I mean? join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you haven't already, it is free to create a profile. The link is in the podcast description. We are watching hoops. We're breaking things down. We're also talking about a whole lot of randomness. We get some wrestling sprinkled in, some video games sprinkled in. It's a vibe. So come rock with us. We let the hair down. We also talk a whole lot of hoop. So come rock with us. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
No yeet.